I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact.
Well, when it comes to punishing whistleblowers, President Obama is proving to be more aggressive than all previous presidents combined.
NSA leaker Edward Snowden has made a lot of enemies since he revealed government spying on Americans' phone and
Manning could face 136 years behind bars.
This is the first ever espionage conviction against a whistleblower in the United States.
The inside scoop on how the UK and the US are colluding to stop whistleblowers.
When is a whistleblower a hero or a criminal? And with the Manning case underway, what is the future of whistleblowing in the federal government?
Heroes to many, traitors to some. The internet has put whistleblowers in the public eye and in the government's crosshairs. With increased access to classified information and the ability to spread it, the world's biggest institutions are running scared and cracking down. On this week's show, we hear about the whistleblowers we don't see on the nightly news. They're not named Manning or Snowden. They're ordinary people who report wrongdoing at their place of employment and pay the consequences. To open up the show, reporter Kerry Klein brings us the story of a poisoned wildlife refuge and the government employee who wouldn't let his agency cover it up.
I was always told, keep the Fish and Wildlife Service off the front page of the newspaper. That way, we're not exposed. The reverse of that is, if you want to get something corrected, make sure it hits the front page of the newspaper. And that's exactly what happened.
In the early 1980s, Felix Smith was involved in one of the biggest environmental disasters to hit the United States. It involved the government, politicians, farmers, and cattle ranchers, and it left an environmental legacy that may never be fully cleaned up. It all took place at what used to be the Kesterson National Wildlife Refuge, at one time a thriving wetland. Smith remembers the first time he visited Kesterson, one morning in June 1983.
If anybody ever goes to a marsh, when you go into the marsh at sunrise, you'll hear all kinds of noise, of birds making chirping and birds feeding, whether ducks or what have you. There's lots of noise in the marsh at sunrise. When we went to this marsh, it was dead silence. There was very little noise, almost no noise. The water did not look right.
On that same day, Smith and his colleague Harry Ohlendorf made the discovery that would launch this entire story, a baby bird half-hatched from its shell, dead.
The bird had deformed legs, it had deformed bill, it had a deformed beak, and its head was grossly swollen. I looked at Harry looked at me, and said, "It looks like our lives are never going to be the same."
This is the south end of Kesterson.
I visited Kesterson on a sunny afternoon in late 2013.
That's a red tail. Yeah, that's a red tail hawk.
It's a 6,000-acre splotch of land right in the middle of California. Today, it's a flat, scrubby grassland, burnt by the sun. No water in sight. I got a tour from a biologist who's been following Kesterson since Smith's time.
My name's Gary Santolo. I'm a wildlife biologist and toxicologist for CH2M Hill. I've been working as the biological monitor at Kesterson since 1988.
Oh, what is that?
A coyote scat. Yeah, there's a healthy population of coyotes here.
Kesterson's history stretches all the way back to the 1960s, with an agreement between the government and a huge group of farmers. Widespread irrigation creates a lot of excess water that can't be reused. So the government agreed to help Central California farmers by building a pipeline to transport their wastewater up to Northern California. But the pipeline was never finished. Where it ended, near a town called Los Banos, the runoff pooled in a cluster of reservoirs that attracted birds and other wild animals. Thus, Kesterson National Wildlife Refuge was born. But there was one not-so-small problem. Agricultural runoff is dirty.
Over time, there was a buildup of selenium salts that precipitated out of the agricultural drain water, and that built up. There were avian die-offs and low reproductivity.
Birds were dying. Coots, grebes, black-necked stilts. They were laying fewer eggs, and their young were being born with horrible deformities at an alarmingly high rate. Eventually, the culprit was found, selenium, an element that's extremely toxic in high doses.
Selenium came from the agricultural drain water. It's natural, but it leaches out of the soils with the irrigation practices. So it's natural selenium, but an unnatural buildup.
Kesterson was a poisoned refuge.
Hi.
Good morning.
You didn't get lost.
I did not.
Come on in.
Thank you.
Felix Smith is now retired, but back in the 1980s, he was a biologist with the Fish and Wildlife Service. He had already been with the service for 27 years when he was assigned to Kesterson in 1983. In the months following their first discovery, Smith and Ohlendorf would find more and more dead birds. The fact that selenium was responsible didn't surprise them.
The state of California, in the early 60s, said that the drainage water coming off the west side was such high in salts and other trace elements that it would not be good for any beneficial uses. So the state of California knew about it in 1960. Nobody raised hell about dumping it on marshes.
Smith and Ohlendorf wrote a memo to regional and national directors at the Fish and Wildlife Service, outlining the problem and its urgency. The directors responded by telling the two of them to keep it quiet.
We were angry at the system. We knew that the drain water was a problem. We suspected it for years. Now that we had the proof, we had the evidence, science supported us.
Smith got impatient and ultimately brought the story to the press. The first article about Kesterson was published in September 1983.
Large numbers of water birds nesting along the edges of the Kesterson Reservoir, north of Los Banos, were born this spring without eyes, beaks, or legs.
It helped launch the career of its author, Deborah Blum, now a Pulitzer Prize-winning environmental writer.
One species, the coot, had deformed young in more than one-third of its nests, more than 30 times the amount expected in such birds.
A second article by Tom Harris came out a few months later, and this one featured pictures of the deformed birds, which ultimately made it onto the nightly news around the country. The government was not amused, especially David Houston, then Secretary of the Interior.
To put it mildly, crap hit the fan. David Houston said he would get the writers, he would get their jobs, he would condemn them to poor journalism. The trouble was, we had already reviewed the data. Tom Harris did exactly what he was told. The data was looked at by some of the same research scientists. They were correct.
It was no secret that Smith was behind this press coverage. At some point, he got a visit from Boyd Mattson, a reporter with National Geographic. Smith was showing Mattson the first Kesterson memo when he received a call from Joe Blum, regional director of the Fish and Wildlife Service, Smith's boss.
I put the telephone on the desk, and we could hear Joe Blum shouting into it about throwing the memo. The memo never existed. Throw it away. And I'm looking at Mr. Mattson, and he's looking at me saying, I can't believe this. Somebody telling you to throw away data. And I said, okay, I'll do it. I'll throw it away. That's it. I don't want to hear any more of it. Goodbye. We hung up. So I said, I'll make you a copy.
Looking back, Smith doesn't remember worrying about what he was doing. But Lloyd Carter, an environmental reporter at the time, remembers differently.
So our first meeting was fairly secretive. We met at the Fresno airport, and we hid behind the palm tree inside because he was so paranoid, and it was making me paranoid. But, part of me was like chuckling, like, oh, come on, man, you're being a little paranoid. But I realized, no, he's not. He has every reason to worry about his job because they would have tried to fire him.
And they did. When Joe Blum tried to transfer him to Portland, Oregon, Smith enlisted the help of Louis Clark, a lawyer from the Government Accountability Project, an organization that offers legal protection to whistleblowers. Smith talks about the day Clark showed up in Sacramento.
Monday morning, he shows up at 8:30 in the Fish and Wildlife Service office, and everybody is stunned that I got an attorney. We sat down about 9 o'clock in front of personnel telling me what I'm doing wrong. And I said, I can't be doing much wrong, I said. I've got all these outstanding awards. We went on for about an hour, and then finally Louis Clark says, you will not demote, you will not harass, you'll not do anything that impinges on the ability of my client to speak the truth. And that was it. They stopped the harassment. I came back to Sacramento and did the work I was supposed to do.
Louis Clark wasn't the only person to come to bat for Smith. George Miller and Bob Matsui, both state representatives at the time, also vouched for his integrity and helped him keep his job. Meanwhile, two local cattle ranchers, Jim and Karen Klaus, came out of the woodwork to petition the state. They owned land adjacent to Kesterson, and they claimed their cattle were suffering from selenium poisoning. Here's environmental reporter Lloyd Carter again.
The cows were dropping dead, or they would act like they were drunk. They would stagger. They call it the blind staggers, and they would flop over. They would go into convulsions. They had sores on their body, their skin. Your skin can be very sensitive to selenium.
Finally, in March of 85, Kesterson was shut down. The ruling came from the State Water Resources Control Board within just 2 years of Smith's first site visit. The pipeline delivering irrigation water was closed, and dirt was trucked in to cover up the contaminated soil. Lloyd Carter still remembers the day of the ruling.
It's the biggest headline I ever got. Kesterson closed, no water to farms.
Suddenly, Felix Smith became known as a whistleblower. At the time, it was not a desirable label to have attached to your name.
In the early 80s, it was the Wild West of whistleblowing because the major laws we use today did not exist. The False Claims Act, the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, the Dodd-Frank Act, the Whistleblower Protection Act, these major pieces of legislation had yet to be enacted.
Stephen Cohn is a lawyer and the executive director of the National Whistleblower Center, where he's been defending whistleblowers in court for 3 decades. Smith fits Stephen's description of a model whistleblower. The first criterion is what you do when you spot an injustice, or when your boss tells you to do something that's morally questionable.
A whistleblower is a person who will step back and think, is there something wrong with this instruction? And you may think everyone does this, but it just is not the case. So the second issue determining whether you will be a whistleblower or not is what do you do when the boss tells you to shut up, mind your own business?
The term whistleblower suggests a lone individual going rogue. But according to Cohn, they're commonly just a single link in a long chain. Without Smith's colleagues and without the Klauses petitioning the state, he may not have won the case. I asked Carter if this collaborative perspective undermined Smith's importance. He said no.
He was the first person outside of the Department of Interior that communicated this information to the general public. That's what makes him the whistleblower. I mean, the Klauses were the victims. Their motivation was clearly, you know, the government's trying to destroy our ranch and kill our cattle. Felix just wanted the truth to get out there.
Carter himself represents another common support element, the press. Smith relied heavily on reporters to deliver his message to the public, and this was the biggest project on Carter's plate for a while.
Troubled waters calamity in the making. U.S. agency accused of misleading state about San Luis drain. Big money buys big clout for West Side's polluting growers.
His 1984 expose on Kesterson,
Poison in the Valley,
was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize.
I was absolutely excited. I knew I was doing stuff that no one else was doing. It's the thrill of being a newsman. You wake up in the morning, here's the headline story, and there's your name. But yeah, it kept me going. I was pumped up.
In hindsight, the story and the characters all seemed to fit together. But Smith could have easily misstepped, especially since he went to the press so early on. Stephen Cohn has seen a lot of whistleblowers stand up for justice and succeed, but he's also seen them fail, catastrophically.
There's a couple of terrible mistakes whistleblowers make.
A military judge has sentenced Army Private Bradley Manning to 35 years in prison.
35 years in prison for what has been described as the largest ever leak of classified government documents.
The first is to think by doing the right thing, you'll be protected. So many whistleblowers just think that if I report this, there'll be some type of protection and things will work out well. And the answer is absolutely not.
We're always taught to do what's right, that justice will prevail. But in this scenario, that's trumped by one thing. No one likes a snitch. Smith never intended to be a whistleblower. In fact, he hated the term.
Yes, whistleblower kind of has the connotation you're a squealy. And I reject that. We've got to get rid of the idea that if you tell the truth, you're squealing on somebody. No, no. We're trying to get the truth out so corrections can be made.
In the midst of Smith's troubles at the office, the Sacramento Bee smeared him in a political cartoon. It shows a hunter and his dog, representing Valley Farmers and the Department of the Interior. Caught in the dog's mouth is a duck labeled Felix Smith. The suggestion is that Smith was bagged.
When they showed it to me, I had to laugh. Aren't too many people get one of those. Nothing. But there was one in the Fresno Bee of a catapult, I think. You can enjoy your job in Portland.
But this was before Kesterson was closed down. So in reality, the hunter and his dog didn't get Smith. He got them.
Well, this is called salt grass. This was here back in the pond days.
Closing down Kesterson was a big win for environmental advocates. But farming and irrigation problems aren't over. Here's Lloyd Carter.
The question is not, is Kesterson shut down? The question is toxic drainage water still being generated? The answer is yes. And so what's happening to it?
At Kesterson, it'll be a long time before selenium is back down below hazardous levels. Maybe never. But Gary Santolo is still optimistic.
It certainly can never be brought back to what it was before it was a reservoir. The selenium is essentially always going to be here. But it's a success in that, you know, everybody worked together to change the habitat to make it not a ongoing problem. And so in that respect, it is a success, I think.
Maybe Gary's right. A small step in a positive direction is still better than a big one in a negative direction. And while one person really can affect change, he or she doesn't have to do it alone. In fact, they shouldn't. Blowing the whistle is tough, but if you do it right, it pays. For Making Contact, from Fresno, California, this is Carrie Klein.
We'll be right back.
Hi, my name is Shelley Kessler, and I work in the labor movement. Making Contact will delve deeper into our issues and into the issues that affect all working people, regardless of whether or not they're in unions. So that's why I support Making Contact. I think it's an opportunity for people to learn more about the communities in which we live and work.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. Because of generous support from listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, Australia, and South Africa. Find out how to donate, download shows, or get our podcast. Go to radioproject.org, like us on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact.
You are listening to Making Contact. I'm Andrew Stelzer. The story we just heard lays out how a lack of legal protections often leaves whistleblowers out in the cold. So we wanted to find out, are there any other countries doing a better job than the United States? If you read a bit on the subject, you'll likely be pointed towards the UK, where the Public Interest Disclosure Act, or PIDA, a law passed in 1998, is often credited as being one of the best whistleblower protection laws in the world. But there are some critics of PETA, and we've got one of the most prominent joining us now via Skype. Eileen Chubb is a former care worker who blew the whistle on the abuse of elderly people she witnessed on the job. She went on to found Compassion in Care, a group that supports those trying to improve the elder care system, including whistleblowers. And she also helped start The Whistler, a group of whistleblowers from various industries and fields, not just care workers, that support and assist each other during and after the whistleblowing process. Eileen Chubb, welcome to Making Contact.
Thank you.
So when did you first see yourself as a whistleblower, and what kind of image did that term create in your mind before you became one?
I didn't even know what the term whistleblower meant. I had no idea. Going back, I was totally naive. I just saw wrongdoing and reported it, thinking that that was the right thing to do and that my company would be pleased.
And what did you see?
Even now, I find it difficult to speak about it. I saw people stripped of every single human right, tortured for pleasure, starved, left with bedsores to the bone, drugged on antipsychotic medication to the point where they were in comas. Illegal drugs were stockpiled, dead people's drugs weren't returned to pharmacy. Everything that you can take from a human being and every way you can hurt a human being, I saw happen. There was actually 7 of us in all. I didn't know that at the time. We were all going to management, senior management, and we were all told not to speak to anyone else. We didn't know anything about Peter at that point because it never occurred to us that we'd done something wrong or that we would suffer because, you know, we tried to protect the people that we looked after. And those people were like our family. So we had no choice but to try to protect them. I went to social services and that's the first time I heard the word PEDA and whistleblower and that you should be protected. What happened was we were subjected to a level of hatred and harassment because they found out we were the whistleblowers because obviously we'd reported internally. They called us the perfect whistleblowers because we'd actually, without knowing it, done everything that PEDA would have required. It wasn't enough. It wasn't enough to protect us, and it wasn't even enough to stop the abuse because it continued in that care home 4 years after we were forced out of the job.
And so what does PEDA say, especially for our American listeners, many of whom have never heard of this, what does PEDA say and how did it specifically fall short in your case?
Not only in my case, because I deal with hundreds of whistleblowers. The first thing that went wrong was it actually identifies whistleblowers. It allows for you to go to a prescribed regulator to report wrongdoing, but you have to jump higher hurdles to do that. It prefers for you to go to your employer. Now, if you go to your employer and report your concerns and nothing is done, and this happens in many cases, the whistleblower is then left with the choice of should they go outside, and if they do, they'll know it's them. Their employer will know it's them because they've already gone to their employer. The second thing where PEDA fails is most whistleblowers, we had no money. PEDA requires a whistleblower to save up before reporting wrongdoing and losing your job. 90% of whistleblowers that come to us have not even got money for food, never mind lawyers. So I've seen people sitting in their house wearing a coat because they have no money for gas or heating, no money for food. And that's bad enough if people have fallen on hard times. But these people are in this position because they did the right thing. PEDA is probably worse than no law, because people think they're protected, but the reality is that PEDA slaps you in the face for good measure.
Well, that brings up another question. Why is it seen as so great? Is it just that the laws of other countries fall even shorter? Why is it credited as being this landmark protection?
I cannot imagine in my wildest dreams why other countries would want to follow suit. The law that we want, EDNA's law, would give whistleblowers protection. EDNA's law would make it a criminal offence to not act on the genuine concerns of a whistleblower. It would also make it a criminal offence to cause harm to a genuine whistleblower. That gives us accountability. The other thing that we would ask for is that the state prosecute. This is not an employment issue. An employment issue is about your working conditions, etc. Whistleblowers are people that are reporting very often criminal offences in the public interest. If it's in the public interest, the state should be the person to prosecute and the whistleblower should be treated as a protected witness.
Over the last few years, some big-name whistleblowers have been in the news. In the U.S., we have Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden. exposing wrongdoing by the U.S. government and military. And connected to both of them, and perhaps more relevant in the U.K., is the involvement of Julian Assange of WikiLeaks, who's currently holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. And many believe his freedom is being restricted because he provided aid to whistleblowers. I'm wondering, how have the attacks on these people affected what we might consider small-time, quote-unquote, whistleblowers like yourself, who aren't exposing issues related to massive armies, wars, and entire nations?
I do think Snowden and Chelsea Manning have helped, to raise awareness about what happens when somebody raises the alarm. And the mad thing is that it can be whatever background and however big or small the wrongdoing, the whistleblower is the person who's crucified for speaking out. We need to change the way that we look at whistleblowing, because believe me, I go all over the country and speak on this. And, tomorrow I say to people, tomorrow your wife or your husband or your daughter could be killed on a train crash. How would you feel if you found out that driver had been reported for dangerous driving previously by a whistleblower and nothing was done? You would be outraged. Well, every day we leave our homes and our lives could be in the hands of a whistleblower. So I'd ask people to support whistleblowers and to think about, the culture that we have about exposing wrongdoing. The thing is, we call whistleblowers snitches. The big expression here at the moment for whistleblowers is, oh, loose lips sink ships. Well, actually, loose lips are the very opposite of what sink ships,
And what about on the side of the companies or institutions? The increased awareness about whistleblowers, has this changed the way these institutions react? Are they more defensive? Are they quicker to actually fix issues because they know otherwise they might become public and it could become a big issue?
I think the balance of power at the moment is in favor of the employer or the wrongdoer, and it's not in favor of the whistleblower. So there's a great deal of complacency in big companies that they cannot be touched, because there's so many PETA cases gone through, like ours, where it actually told us in our verdict, in writing, that we had not sufficiently considered the consequences to ourselves before we reported the disclosures. That is like saying we were wrong to report the abuse that we saw. So those are the kinds of judgments that are coming through PETA. And if PETA is the best in the world, then all I can say is God help the rest of the world.
Eileen Chubb is founder of Compassion in Care, a group that supports those that, like herself, are trying to expose and end the abuse of elders in the care system. And she also works with The Whistler. You can find links to those organizations and other resources on our website, radioproject.org. Eileen, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Check out our website, radioproject.org, to get a podcast, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. I'm Andrew Stelzer. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.